and individualism, every single institution, every measure. And yet at the same time, what is today's dominant white racial narrative? Well, I am a former professor of education, so I used to teach in a large teacher training program. We put out hundreds of future teachers every year. The program was 97% white, and we were 10 miles from a city, Springfield, Massachusetts, which is 56% Black and Latinx. It was rare for me to ever have a student of color in any class, and on the first day, I'd ask my students to take out a piece of paper and write me an anonymous reflection on a couple key questions. How racially diverse were your schools and neighborhoods growing up? What messages have you gotten across your life about race? And what are some of the ways in which your race has shaped your life? And what I'm about to show you is representative of the virtually hundreds of these anonymous reflections I've gathered from our future teachers in their junior and senior years of university, soon to be certified as highly educated, and set forth to teach in Springfield Public Schools. My neighborhood growing up was not racially diverse at all. Every family in my neighborhood was also Caucasian. Throughout my time in school, I have continually been taught that skin does not matter. Is that familiar to you? It should be, because this is today's dominant post-civil rights narrative. And I see a huge contradiction in those three sentences, right? If race doesn't matter, why so separate? And from that comes a question for me, which is, how do we actually teach that race doesn't matter in segregation? And I will argue that we don't teach that at all. We tell that. It is not what we teach from the actual practice of our lives, which is vastly more powerful than the words that we say. A couple other things I want to point out. This is all this student could be bothered to write. And this is the younger generation. And you know how the story goes? When all the old people die off, there'll be no more racism? Because it's really old people. This narrative is no more transgressive than the narrative I was raised with or my father was raised with, because our outcomes have not changed. And we always have to look at outcomes. So this is not challenging racism. And so we need to really deconstruct it. And basically the question that drives my work is, how do we pull that off? How do they pull that off? And another challenge to the white folks in the room, try not to distance yourself from these narratives. So you may be a little more sophisticated in what you say, but I absolutely recognize this consciousness. This is the consciousness I was raised with. And so keep trying to say, all right, what does that look like for me in myself? How might I relate to it? Okay, so very quickly, we have to be on the same page with our terms. Prejudice is prejudgment. We get it across our lifespan. All human beings have socially learned prejudices towards other groups of social human beings, based on whatever given culture you're in. And everyone acts on prejudice through action. So the way you see the world drives the way you respond in the world, and the vast majority of it is unconscious. And so everybody has it and everybody does it. Human objectivity is not possible. And so we can remove the word reverse from this discussion. Okay? It's nonsensical. When we move into oppression, however, we're at a different level, because now we have a group's collective bias, both conscious and primarily unconscious, backed by legal authority and institutional control, and it is transformed. No individual has to do anything, intend anything. The system itself will reproduce the inequality. So it gets embedded, that bias gets embedded in every single institution and also in cultural definitions of what's normal, whose experience is attested to and whose is not, whose stories are told by whom, who displays appropriate emotions in which context, who is a good fit, who's prepared to hit the ground running, who's qualified, who's beautiful, valuable, and normal, right? And who is in the position to set those parameters, right? So just a very quick example to drive home this point, because dominant culture uses these terms interchangeably, and that takes power off the table. So women in the United States, and I'm using cisgender terms right now, deliberately, women in the United States got the right to vote in 1920. Who gave women the right to vote? All right, was there any other way women could get the right to vote? No, why not? Yes, we did not hold institutional power. We could not give ourselves the right to vote. We could certainly be prejudiced and discriminate against men on one-on-one interactions. It wouldn't be nice. But women as a group could not literally deny men their civil rights. And men as a group could deny women their civil rights. That is a very significant difference that must be acknowledged in language. Okay? So today, if men as a group want to take away our civil rights, could they? Mumble, mumble. Well, it was a little harder to answer that about 6 months ago, but I think it's pretty clear today. So let's just look. Today, 2017, Fortune 500 CEOs, 98% male. I believe economic power is the ultimate source behind all other forms. The top 10 richest Americans are all men. The Congress is 81% male. The Republican side is 90% male. Presidency and vice presidency, always 100% male. The current cabinet, 91% male. The U.S. mayors, 82% male. The U.S. governors, 92% male. Let me just ask you again, if they wanted to, could they? A little more clarity in the room. And that was about 10 seconds of the simplest information that's in front of every one of us every day. And that's another way that oppression manifests. So normalized, so taken for granted, so obscured. In fact, to simply name that fact is to be told you are bashing men. That even though it's in front of us, again, it's hard to see. And so this also illustrates another really key dimension of oppression, is that it's deeply embedded, historic, and by definition is not a fluid system of power. Patriarchy did not end in 1920, and I'm very confident that if Hillary Clinton had become president, patriarchy wasn't going to end on that day. Any more than we can clearly see that not only did not racism end upon Obama's presidency, it got a big infusion. Right? All right, so just give you a little visual there. This is the House Freedom Caucus. It's arguably the most powerful committee in the country. Again, we live in patriarchy. Here's a little cultural image. This is 2015's cover of Vanity Fair. Why late night TV is better than ever. I made this slide, I don't know this guy, he's my archetype of a white man. I just Googled white guy and that's what I got. But I made this to drive home something that for me is just is stunning. Of the 100 top films worldwide, 99 were directed by men. By definition, oppression is the ability to disseminate your experience, perspective, and worldview to everybody worldwide and to shape how everybody sees themselves and one another. Okay? All right, so Facebook puts out these happy holiday things. You may have seen them, and they put this out on August 26th, Happy Women's Suffrage, to commemorate the passage of suffrage. And then some women did this. Which women got access to the vote in 1920? So this is another way that oppression manifests. The dominant group's experience stands in as universal. There is not a universal woman's experience. There is not a universal experience of motherhood. My race, my class, my sexuality profoundly shape my gender experience. Okay. All right, so while we were oppressed as women, we were held up as white. And I just have to say, white women don't land any more softly on people of color, okay? So white women, we have some work to do. Yes, we experience sexism, but we do not experience racism. And those things intersect in complex ways, and it's on us to figure out how they intersect, not to exempt ourselves from those intersections. So racism is a form of oppression. It is a system. It is deeply embedded through the fabric and foundation of the entire society. It is not dependent on your intentions, your self-image, or your friendships. It is the water we are swimming in. It works on every level to ensure consistently an unequal distribution of resources between white people overall and people of color overall, with white people the beneficiaries of that distribution. And while all groups who are not defined and perceived as white in this country experience racism, and to really understand racism, you have to understand the different histories, struggles, trajectories of various groups of color, how they've been positioned in relationship to one another, all of those nuances, which we don't have time to look at today. But I do want to take just one group, because I do believe in the white mind, the ultimate racial other is black. There is a deep anti-black sentiment in this country that is like no other, and we have to grapple with it and take account of it. So I want to just take one glance at the history in this country towards African Americans. We can think of it literally as state-sanctioned, organized crime. It begins with 246 years of brutality and enslavement, and it's traced all the way into the present, and I'll pick it up. And I do want to make a point that there were literal bans on testifying against whites, which made it virtually legal to murder black people. You'd have to question whether it might not still be legal. But we can pick it up at employment discrimination, educational discrimination, bias laws and policing practices, white flight, cultural erasures and attacks, subprime mortgages, mass incarceration, racist media representation, untold history, and more. African Americans have never and are not in the position to do this to white people. White people have always been and continue to be in the position to do this to African Americans. And so we can remove the word reverse from this discussion also. There is no reverse form of racism. By definition, it is a one-way system of power. Okay? And to say reverse is to minimize, trivialize, and basically protect. Okay? And yet, what are we taught racism is? Right? Well, post-civil rights, it adapted quite brilliantly with what I think of as the good-bad binary. So post-civil rights, to be a good moral person and be complicit with racism, became mutually exclusive. So we saw racists on the television, and they had fire hoses, and they were dragging people from lunch counters and beating them, and we were shocked, and we were against that, and therefore we were not racists. They were racists. Racists were bad, and not racists were good. And I actually think this either-or proposition is the root of virtually all white defensiveness on this topic. Have you all noticed any white defensiveness? Just checking. So basically, you suggest that I'm racist or that I've said or done anything racially problematic, and what I hear is you've just questioned my very moral character, and I need to defend my moral character, and I will. I will defend it with every way I can to minimize, negate, and deny that that could have been racism, because I'm not racist, because I am a good person who is against racism. Right? And so we know how to fill that in. So racists are bad and ignorant, bigoted, prejudiced, mean-spirited, old, southern. Drive pickup trucks, we'll get a little classism in there. They live in Baton Rouge? I don't know. Not racists are good, educated, progressive, open-minded, well-intended, young, northern. We shop at Whole Foods. No, actually, we don't shop at Whole Foods because that's a corporation. We shop at the food co-op. And while we live in Seattle, we're moving to Portland, Oregon really soon. All right, I do enjoy poking fun at white progressives, and I suspect there's a lot of us in this room. And that's because I am a white progressive, and I absolutely get how we think. And sincerely, when I started this work, I thought that my credentials for not being racist were that I was a vegetarian. I'm a vegetarian, therefore I'm not racist. This idea, right, that, you know, it's all about open-mindedness. I actually, at this point, believe that white progressives are the hardest on people of color. Okay? Because the degree to which we think we're good to go, for whatever reason we're going to give you that we're good to go, all of our energy goes there into establishing our exemption from this system, this water we're all swimming in, and none of our energy goes to what we need to be doing for the rest of our lives, which is deep education, reflection, analysis, action. Right? So we need to get rid of it. It's not a good or bad. And if you're feeling defensive or unsettled right now, and you're white, it's see if it isn't rooted in this. There's another thing that's happening that can also cause defensiveness in white people, and that is I'm generalizing, and that's a no-no, right? Because individualism says we're all unique and different, and if you just knew all these things about me, you'd know why I was different from everybody you're talking about, which actually would show me that you aren't. but as a sociologist, I'm actually quite comfortable generalizing. These are very well documented patterns, and again, our job is to figure out how they manifest in our particular story, not how our particular story exempts us. So I want you to just reflect for a moment on a couple of questions. They're pretty deep, and I hope you take them away with you. The first one is to think about how racially diverse your neighborhood was growing up, and what you learned about race from the geography of race. And if you're like most people in this country, and if you're white, you grew up in a primarily white neighborhood, white people live the most segregated lives, and you probably grew up in a good, safe, sheltered neighborhood, and you learned some very, very powerful messages about race from those very words, from the very fact that we live so separate. And if you didn't grow up in racial segregation, you're probably urban and poor or working class. You also learned your place in the racial hierarchy. You just learned it differently. So that's not a axis of exemption either. Okay. I want you to think about your teachers. And when's the first time you had a teacher of the same race as yourself, or races if you're multiracial, and how often? And when's the first time you had a teacher of a different race, and how often? And if you're like most people in this country, your answer if you're a white is, from the moment I began and I could get through graduate school, rarely if ever in my entire life looking up and not seeing myself reflected at the front of the room. And if I was a person of color outside of a few special pockets in this country, my answer is probably rarely if ever in my entire life did I look up and see myself represented at the front of the room. So our teachers are powerful role models. They impart a worldview. They are the deciders of who's good, who's bad, who's smart. And our teaching force nationwide is 83% to 93% white. It's actually getting whiter, not less. And our schools are almost back to pre-Board of Education levels of segregation. Those white teachers answer these questions the way most white people answer them. Only ever grew up in primarily white environments, only ever had white teachers. So we have to think about where we're getting our understanding of people of color, and it doesn't tend to be from a wide variety of authentic, sustained cross-racial relationships. It comes from media, jokes, omissions, warnings, etc. But now we're in the position to make determinations and, in shorthand, school-to-prison pipeline. And again, by every measure, these decisions are made with racial disparity, and they're probably not intentional. I just have an image for you. This is from last year's College Jeopardy Champion Playoffs, and those are our best and our brightest, and that's the board at the end of the Grand Champion round. And as we can see, there's one category, not one of those scholars touched. Must have been the hardest. So I want to say a couple things about this. First of all, you know what's under that category. Civil War and civil rights. Always. Because that's their history. Happened in a vacuum, apparently. No, that is our history. It's the absolute deep entwined history of this country. And it can be traced into the present. But that disconnect leaves us with some very problematic explanations for current inequality. The other point I want to make is that I want you to think about the weight of the white worldview. Most of us have been taught by white people who've 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 been taught by white people. Using textbooks written by, for, and about white people. Starting to get that? Right? Right. So what do we hear when we raise the topic of race around our fellow white people? Well, I do have a kind of unique job. So I stand in front of rooms like this every day and start talking about racism and then start pushing white people to connect to their own. And in doing that, I hear the same narratives over and over. And I literally got this image in my mind of a dock or a pier. And what it signifies is how superficial or surface these narratives are, and yet ubiquitous, right? And so one more point. Like that dock, it looks like it's just floating on the surface of the water. But of course it's not. There's a whole structure underneath propping that dock up. And that's what we have to get at. That's what I'm trying to get at when I ask you to think about your neighborhoods, your schools, your teachers. What is that meaning-making system that we internalized very early that causes us to have the responses that we so often have? So probably the number one white racial narrative on the topic of racism is, I was taught to treat everyone the same. So how many people in here were taught to treat everyone the same? Okay, you ready? No, you weren't. In fact, not one single person in the room was actually taught to treat everyone the same. You can't be taught to do that. You can be told to do that. So I get that you were told, lectured, but as human beings, you can't be taught in a way that you could learn to actually do it. So in other words, you don't respond to everybody the same. This has empirically been shown. Much of those responses are not necessarily conscious, but they're happening. And we don't really even want to, because people have different needs. So we don't, in fact, and I just need to tell you something, if this is one of your favorite narratives. It's not convincing to people of color. When people of color hear a white person say this, they're not thinking, oh great, I'm with a woke white person. They're usually, I don't know, some version of their eyes rolling, oh boy, here we go. Okay? So, all right, I see people as individuals. I don't care if you're pink or purple or polka dotted. I hope no one in this room would ever say anything so demeaning or dismissive. Racism in the past doesn't have any meaning to me. Everyone struggles. My parents weren't racist, that's why I'm not racist. My parents were racist, that's why I'm not racist. It doesn't matter what comes first, correct answer will always be, I am not racist. That's the good-bad binary, and you know, so-and-so just happened to be black, but it has nothing to do with why no one in the office gets along with her. And this is another one, since I have a captive audience, I'm asking you to remove reverse from your vocabulary. I'd like you to consider removing anything on the topic of race that begins with regardless of race, just happened to be, yes, but at the human level we can all agree. Because what you're doing in that move, and it is a move, is you are positioning some kind of universal shared experience. And in this society, there is not one. And you're basically positioning the white experience as universal. I might not know what race has to do with why no one in the office is getting along with this coworker, but I need to be willing to grapple with how race is shaping my response to her, because all the research shows that it is. So these are all colorblind. And in a room this big, some of us still have colorblind. Some of us understand it's not realistic, it's not true, we're not colorblind. It has not gotten us better outcomes. It has actually functioned to protect white advantage and to deny the relevancy of race in a very racist culture. So what do the more hip white folks say? You know, the ones that are moving to Portland? As soon as they pack up their Priuses, okay. Again, I drive a Prius. That's why I'm making fun of myself. All right. Well, we say things like this. Oh, I work in a very diverse environment. Mm-hmm. Now, not all of us can say that, so we'll find some version of that, right? I used to tutor on the reservation. I taught in a rough school. I have people of color in my family. Me? I'm not racist. I used to live in New York. I really have heard that on more than one occasion. This one gets used interchangeably with, I'm not racist, I'm from Hawaii. I'm not racist, I'm from Canada. I'm not racist, I grew up in Germany. And I'm not racist, I was in the military. Because there's no racism in any of those places. And sociologists actually have a term for this narrative. It's called the inoculation. I have been near people of color, and that stripped me of all my racism. Okay. The bubble over my head on the New York one is like, really? You walked by people of color and you didn't lose your shit? Wow. You are not racist. Okay. So how many of you in a conversation with a white person have heard some version of these narratives? And if we're being honest, we've probably said some version of these narratives. Okay, just about everybody. So let's do a little bit of discourse analysis, right? Let's really unpack what is the person really saying or doing, and what are they drawing from? So a person who invokes some version of these narratives when the topic is racism, and particularly a white person, is giving you their evidence. Right? Topic's racism, I say one of these things, I'm giving you my evidence. In my mind, what is this my evidence of? Exactly. I'm not racist. So if that's my evidence for not being racist, what's my definition of a racist? Well, clearly a racist couldn't work three cubicles down from a person of color. I need to ask the folks of color in the room, could a racist work three cubicles down? Thank you. All right. Clearly, a racist couldn't have people call in their family, and apparently there are no racists in New York City. Okay, I will just leave that there. Again, look at it. It is the evidence the person is using, and so a racist must not be able to do those things. So apparently a racist cannot tolerate the very sight of a person of color, right? If there is fond regard across race, there cannot be racism. That's what we're saying. And so even an avowed, card-carrying white nationalist can do all those things. You do know that, don't you? Okay. And so for a white progressive, I can have all kinds of unconscious, very problematic patterns, assumptions, etc., and be perpetrating racism in all of those situations. I do have friends of color, and that does not free me of problematic patterns on occasion in those relationships. So I'm going to ask another rhetorical question to the folks of color. Do you have any white people in your life that you love that have some racist patterns? Okay, right. It does not free us of racism. Anymore, I happen to be married to a man, and because he loves me, trust me, he has not been stripped of his sexism. And my marriage is not free of all gender. Quite the contrary, right? And we seem to be able to do this with gender. We understand we'll struggle across these differences. But when it comes to race, fond regard, no more racism, right? Couple more, children are so much more open. The research shows that by age 3 to 4, I'm very sorry to say, all children who grow up here understand by age 3 to 4 that it's better to be white. No child misses the message, and it is not an isolated message. It is relentless, and not a person in the room missed the message either. And to leave children unattended to it is to not prepare them to resist it. I marched in the 60s. I had a feeling that would touch a nerve in this crowd. So here's what I'm going to say. Damn, I wished I'd marched in the 60s. Because then I would be certified as free of all racism for the rest of my life. So yes, thank you. And I mean this sincerely. Any white person who marched in the 60s, thank you. It had to happen. Racism is our problem. We had to get involved. Okay? And now, that doesn't free you of any further examination for the rest of your entire life. I'm pretty sure some of those white progressives that went down to the South to save the black people were running some martyr syndrome, some white savior, all kinds of problematic taking over of the movement. There were things going on, right? And we didn't even know race wasn't biological in the 60s. So this is not convincing either. I already know all this because I had that class, I read that book. I told you I've been to Costa Rica. Okay, and finally, we don't like how white our neighborhood is, but we had to move here for the schools. Okay, you know I could talk about that, but we'll just leave it there. I'll say in a nutshell, I think it's disingenuous. And a question I want to give to us is, why is it okay for somebody's children to have an inferior education, but not ours? And how do we even know? But I do want to add that piece. For in the white mind, the mere presence of a significant number of particular groups of color automatically makes it an inferior school. And so I also want to say that it may not be at all. Okay. All right, so we really need to go underneath and look at what is allowing us to say such things that are so unconvincing, that do not actually do what we think they're doing, which is position ourselves as good to go. But I want you to notice a couple things. The first set of narratives I put up here were colorblind, right? The first set of narratives I put up here were colorblind. I don't see it, or if I see it, it has no meaning to me. And so I'm, you know, nothing more to discuss. Let's move on. The second set of narratives are not colorblind. They're color celebrate. I value, I love, I embrace diversity, right? But ask yourself how they function. Those narratives function the same way colorblind narratives function. They exempt the person from any further engagement. They pretty much position you as outside, nothing to see here, let's move on. I am not a part of the problem. I have no further investigation or action to be taking. Right. So sociologist Joe Fagan has the concept of the white racial frame, and it's the deeply internalized framework through which whites make racial meaning. It includes images, interpretations, and actions that position whites as superior and that are passed down and reinforced throughout society. I'm going to just start showing you some images of the white racial frame, because what I'm trying to push against over and over is to get you way deeper than what you have consciously in the front of your brain. Consciously in the front of my brain, I am against racism, and I love several people of color. Unconsciously, deep within me, I have been socialized into a profoundly racist society, and I am filled with all kinds of problematic racist images, investments, and frameworks. I could not have avoided that. So trying to get you to see at that deeper level, and let's just look at some images that I think capture the white racial frame. This is an ad for Intel. It's a little bit older. Maximize computing performance and maximize the power of your employees. There are six shirtless brown men kneeling at the foot of this white man. So look at the body language. And now here's a newer version from The Blind Side. I picked this because it's an Academy Award winning acclaimed film. Both of these images for me powerfully illustrate the white racial frame. This was on CNN, Most Beautiful Women from Around the World. And representing South Africa, which is 92% black. Okay. So I want to say something about the term white supremacy. And I know there's been some controversy about it. And basically, white supremacy is an incredibly descriptive term for the culture we're in. It is not being used to talk about the KKK, are white nationalists. And I know that it's charged for older white folks, but you're going to have to move up to date because it's being used more and more precisely because it's so descriptive of everything I'm trying to show you. So white as superior, right? White as signifier of the human norm. White as ideal, as ideal beauty, as ideal culture. And to use, for example, Charlize Theron to illustrate South Africa is, for me, a really cogent example of white supremacy. So this is my book, What Does It Mean to Be White? And now I'm going to kind of map out how I've been shaped by growing up in the culture of white supremacy. And every other white person in this room can say most of all what I'm going to say, and no person of color in this room can do that. So first, I was born into a culture in which I belong. In virtually, I belong in this room. I belong walking down these corridors. Any situation deemed normal, neutral, or valuable. It is not me who carries the psychic burden of racialization. I belong at that administration meeting. I belong at that church service, block party, dealing with my daughter's teachers, her camp counselors. I belong at that wedding. How many of you have been to a wedding that if it wasn't all white, it was pretty close? Okay, now who comes to our weddings, right? Our circles, either wide or small, but the key people in our life are at our weddings. And it's not ever me that's the one or two in that setting. I'm represented in the halls of power. We looked at gender earlier, now let's look at race. They're a little bit hard to separate out when you get to the halls of power. And I put the statistic up here because it's about power, not numbers. All right, presidency, vice presidency. We know the stats there. House of Representatives is 78% white, US Senate 90. I'm gonna show you a series of photographs now where you see the yellow border around the picture. Those are the people of color in that group. These are the US senators. Leaders of the largest US companies. U.S. Supreme Court, U.S. governors, U.S. top military advisors, people who decide which TV shows we see, people who choose which movies get made, people with the most influence over which books we read, people who decide which music gets produced, people who decide what news is covered, owners of men's pro basketball teams, because we do live in patriarchy, owners of men's pro football teams, owners of men's pro baseball teams, presidents of Ivy League universities. And of those 99 film directors, 95 were white men. Now you're just gonna have to believe me that I'm not trying to pick on Paul Ryan, regardless of how I might feel about him. But when I saw this photograph, I'm like, this is what it means to be white. This is Paul Ryan and his incoming group of interns. To be white is to be included, to belong, to have advantage, opportunity, networking, resources. These are our future politicians. And I feel I can say they most likely don't have authentic, sustained cross-racial relationships. But they will be in the position to make decisions that affect all of our lives. And now, imagine these are our medical researchers. These are our teachers. These are our boards of directors. These are our professors. I could go on. These are our editors. I was raised Catholic, and I don't know if there's a more powerful image than God. This is what I saw when I looked up. There's God creating man, Jesus and Mary, the mother of God made white. Because the historical figures of Jesus and Mary were not white. Whites are the norm for humanity. I saw those and I thought, oh, that would be a good way to show that. Because they don't even have any skin on, right? You've all seen those in your science classes. Here's a close-up. Even with their skin off, they're white. There's Adam and Eve, the first humans. Now, I understand that Adam and Eve are biblical characters, but the first humans did come from the continent of Africa. So again, back to the term white supremacy, white as the representative of humanity and the human ideal, right? Constant messages that it's better to be white. Children don't miss it. We don't miss it. They're not isolated. Here's just one example, best hair. And we have Halle Berry here with her hair straightened. It's a very powerful message. Again, white as signifier for ideal. These are the People Magazine's World's Most Beautiful Women. Now, I think that's ridiculous, but every time I go to the grocery store, I see it, and so do my children. So this is 2015's World's Most Beautiful Woman. This is 2016's World's Most Beautiful Woman. This is 2017's World's Most Beautiful Woman. And Julia Roberts, so darn beautiful, they had to go back to her 5 times. Right? All the women in the world got to keep going back to that Julia Roberts. Point is, white is signifier for ideal. And I have internalized it. And so have all other white people in this room. Now, so have people of color. That's a whole other conversation. But for the white people in the room, we must grapple with this because we bring it to the table with us. These are the top 5 Miss Teen runners-up. Miss Teen USA, this year's top 5 runners-up. And yes, those are 5 different girls. You have to concentrate. But on the side, see North Carolina, Nevada, Texas. But just take it in. Miss Teen USA. This is the group that they were drawn from. And is pretty much always the case. There'll be one, maybe two to the back or the side. And because I know my people, I'm confident that that one black girl there in the back is going to be all these white girls' evidence for why they're not racist. Because they were all great and friends and nobody had an issue with her. So first of all, if you sat down with her, you might get a different story. But what I'm trying to move us past is this idea that it's about friendliness rather than about the very structure that set that up and what that does to us in every moment. This is on a science website right now. What would the scientifically perfect face look like? Is this the perfect face? I was racially affirmed throughout my childhood, and I've just got one image from today to make this point. No little girl misses the message. Here's a scene from The Blind Side. Of course, I've seen this my whole life, depicting black and brown space. Look at the barrenness. And then contrast it with the white savior family who rescues him. Look at that abundance. Look at that Christian benevolence. And of course, Mrs. Toohey's a hero. So these are shows that many of us grew up with. They're all about ideal friendship. They're all television shows. They take place across the decades. We have Seinfeld in the 80s, Sex in the City in the 90s, Friends in the 2000s. There's Gossip Girl, which apparently was the best show ever. And then here's Girls, which just ended its 6th season. So these are all hugely popular TV shows about ideal friendship. They've been exported worldwide. And every one of these shows takes place in New York City, arguably the most racially diverse city in the country. So over and over, the message to me is, even amongst diversity, there's no actual value in an integrated life. So I want to close this piece by saying that perhaps the most profound way that my life has been shaped by my race is that I could be born into, I could learn, I could play, I could worship, I could study, I could love, I could work, and I could die in racial segregation. And not one person in my entire life who's ever loved or mentored me has ever conveyed to me that I've lost anything. I'm going to say this a couple times in a couple ways because I believe it's the most powerful message of all. That I could literally go to my grave with very few authentic, sustained cross-racial relationships. And no one would suggest that anything had been missing or there were any limitations to my life. My wedding looked a lot like that. Why would my funeral not look a lot like that? Now, it won't because I've worked very, very hard. But if I just simply followed the trajectory that my loving parents laid out for me, that is what my life would end with and like. And so the fundamental message is there is no inherent value in the perspectives or experiences of people of color. If they were seen as valuable, I would have been given those in school, the way my parents guided me. But I was actually warned to avoid black and brown space. White people actually measure the value of our environments by the absence of people of color. I know exactly what a good school is, and I know where it is, and I know what a good neighborhood is too, and I know where it is, and I know when a neighborhood's coming up, where what's happening, and when it's going down, what's happening. And those are all racialized discourses, and they're constantly communicating something powerful to me. And so my psychosocial development was inculcated in the water of white supremacy. I didn't want it. I didn't choose it. I'm not good or bad. But my psychosocial development was inculcated in this water. It is in my worldview. It is in my personality. And it is in the way that we are. So what does it look like with white progressives? Right? Because we're not, you know, I don't think we're the far right or any of those images we might have of those folks. It looks like our defensiveness. It looks like our apathy. It looks like our silence. It looks like all those narratives and all those evidences and that unexamined. It looks like after I give this talk, the five people they're going to rush up to tell me, yeah, but we were Italian and Italians used to be. Or yeah, I had red hair and so I experienced discrimination in school. Or don't you think, right? It's our lack of humility. It's our complacency. It's our arrogance. That's what it looks like. It's when racism gets on the table, how qualified we feel to determine whether people of color's experiences are legitimate or not. It manifests in all those ways. And I think that the most hostile, toxic environment for people of color day in and day out is unexamined whiteness. Right? So we may have more people of color around us, but if we haven't fundamentally challenged our patterns, the dynamics, they may survive with us, but they don't thrive. And so that's the question you have to take back to yourselves is what does it look like in our environments, right? What space is there? Right? And there was a third question I didn't go over, which is what are some of the ways in which your race has shaped your life? And when I'm in a different setting, a more workshop setting, and I have the opportunity to have white people reflect on that question, it's really common for white people to answer it by telling a story about a cross-racial experience. Can you picture that? So you turn to your partner and you say, you know, what are some of the ways your race has shaped your life? And then I tell you about how when I was four, and this is how the story will usually go. When I was four, I had this little friend, and she was Asian, but I never noticed it. And then one day my dad said something, and then, right, you can imagine that, right? Or I just start talking about some moment or incident in which I became aware of race. This is a very common way that white people answer the question, how has your life been shaped by your race? But I want you to notice it doesn't answer the question. Your cross-racial experience at 4 years old is not how race has shaped your life. But what it reveals is how deeply we define race as what's happening when people of color are present. And if they are not present, there is no race. That white space is devoid of race. No, white space is teeming with race. And I would say it's teeming with racism. It's a function of structural racism that for as long as we have had white space, people of color have tried to integrate. In many, many ways, we've prevented it. So you don't have to have had a cross-racial experience at all in order to answer the question, how has my life been shaped by my race? For me, it would start like this. Well, when my mother was pregnant with me, the environmental safety that she could live in as she carried me, the nutrition that was available to her, the transportation, the education, the hospital that I could be delivered in, who delivered me, how my mother was treated in the hospital as she delivered me, who owned the hospital, and who came in that night and mopped the floor. I was born into a racialized hierarchy. The forces of white supremacy have been operating on my life before I was even born. And that's where we need to begin to answer this question. And it's not about being good or bad. But left unexamined, we will perpetrate it. Because the default of our society is the reproduction of racial inequality. It does it beautifully. Our schools do it beautifully. We all know this. If our schools were not fantastically efficient mechanisms for the reproduction of racial inequality, we would not care what schools our kids went to, but boy, do we care, right? So the reproduction of all of this just depends on really, you know what it depends on? White people being really nice. Just be really nice. Smile, be friendly, it will just continue on. Because niceness is not courageous. And niceness is not going to get racism on the table, and it's not going to keep it on the table when everyone wants it off the table. You might not even be seen as that nice if you bring up racism. It takes courage and commitment and humility. Right? So if we go back and we look at what I think is propping up, kind of how we pull this off, I think the good-bad binary is incredibly effective. Deep implicit bias. And notice that all the images I showed you were the banality of whiteness as ideal. There's a whole nother layer which is straight up racist representations that we've all been exposed to. Individualism, this idea of us all being unique and special and different and therefore exempt. Universalism, which is the idea that, God, you know, we're good people here, we can represent everybody, we can speak for everybody. When it comes to race, we'll go to them. But we've got everything else covered because we're objective and they are not. They're the holders of racial knowledge. Internalized superiority, which you cannot help internalizing. You can't. You have it. And that requires a lifelong commitment because every moment that I push against my socialization, all the forces are pushing it right back at me. I will never be done in my life. And then the power of segregation, and just in case, because I know my people really well, in case you're sitting here and you're white and you don't see yourself as living a segregated life, that's great. That doesn't free you of racism. You still have something to look at, and that's for you to figure out. And if you have people of color in your life and you aren't talking about your racism with them, your relationships are probably not quite as close as you think they are, right? The question I want to offer back to you is, how do you know? How do you know? Are you in accountability relationships with people of color? Do they give you feedback? If they don't, either you don't have anybody in your life or you have somehow conveyed that you're not open or receptive. Right? And we'll talk about white fragility in my next session. All right. So, what do I do? That's the number one question I get. What do I do? I'm going to put it back on you. And say, what about your life? How have you managed to be a full professional adult and not know what to do about racism? Sincerely, how have you managed? And if you really sit down and take that question seriously and start mapping out how you have managed to not know what to do, you'll have your answer of what to do. But I will tell you some things you can do. All right, all of these things I'll just kind of leave up here. The first three are really all about that internal openness and humility. And then we're in a cultural moment when there's so much good information. There's really no excuse. And so part of breaking with whiteness is taking the initiative to go seek that information out, right? And if you aren't going to do any of that, you're just going to say, well, that was an interesting talk, or she said that one thing I disagreed with, therefore I reject it. That's okay, but acknowledge that that is a conscious choice, because as Howard Zinn says, there is no neutral position on a moving train. Inaction is action. And so I thank you very much for your time and attention. Thank you. Oh, I gotta get a picture. And by the way, I saw some of you taking pictures, which is fine, but on my website, you can download lots of handouts, and lots of this stuff is on there, so it's out there for you.
And if you're interested in going to the next workshop that Robin is going to hold, White Fragility, it's in location R0708, as is the workshop, The Role of White Silence in Racial Discussions. 315 is the next workshop. Thank you.
We did it. Did I hit it?
I just want you, Rosemary Farshall, the president of the Star King School.